the Record from KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
I'm Steve Scher. As we heard recently in reports from the U.S. and globally, climate change is already having an impact on our lives. Water is growing scarce in some regions. Torrential rains are hitting others. Heat waves are more common. The Northwest sees more precipitation fall as rain than snow, causing flooding. Wildfires are worse. Sea levels rise 3 to 6 feet in some places. To forestall even worse impacts, nations would have to cut their CO2 emissions by 40 to 70% within 40 years. Michael Herberg is the research director in the Energy Security Program at the Seattle-based NBR, the National Bureau of Research. Herberg spent 20 years in strategic planning roles in the oil industry. The basic problem, he says, who should pay?
And so you have this deep schism between the developing countries that say, you guys already got rich and filled it up. And the rich countries saying, well, if China and India don't do anything, nothing will matter anyway because it's too big. So the developing countries say, you've got to pay us. You've first got to make room in the atmosphere by reducing your emissions to practically zero. That makes some room in the atmosphere. Then you've got to pay us, give us the technology to transform our energy system so that our emissions slow down. So you basically got a battle over who pays the price, who pays the cost of adjusting your energy system by putting a big tax on carbon, which makes energy more expensive, at least carbon-based energy much more expensive. And the inability to come to an agreement on that means that nothing global happens, nothing sizable enough like a carbon tax or those things doesn't happen, and so we're all kind of living on borrowed time.
Mike Herberg is research director for NBR's Energy Security Program, and among his positions for ARCO over the last 20 years, he was director of portfolio risk management and director for emerging markets. Anything that the global community decides is in the end going to mean that I'm paying twice as much for my gasoline or more and my energy as an American.
You got to punish fossil fuel use, which, you know, we can do it with all kinds of mandates and other things, but the simplest way is to make it expensive, and the markets then begin to work for you. People say, I don't want to pay that, and let's move in the other direction.
So many people who believe in wind and solar, even though all the problems with, you know, frequency and the like, believe it is the future because at least you're not generating CO2 emissions.
Well, I mean, absolutely it is. Key question is, how fast can you move in that direction? I mean, think if you see like me, you could see the scale of the global energy system, the trillions and trillions of dollars, and the scale of the infrastructure and the industry. You got it today. Modern renewables in the global energy mix, wind, solar, modern renewables represent what 2-3% of the entire global energy mix.
But is that technology or political will again? Or the cost of carbon again.
What's happening is we are pushing the development of that at extraordinarily high rates. The fastest growing, in terms of rate, of energy in the next 20 years is already renewables. But it's starting from such a tiny base, and you've got global energy consumption still gradually growing by 1.5% a year. At the same time, you're growing fast, but this tiny little sliver in that stacked up energy consumption, that it can grow extraordinarily fast, which it's doing, but you still have a system that's 85% dependent on fossil fuels, oil, coal, and natural gas. Being able to push renewables fast enough to make the difference is just near physically impossible in a 20-year horizon.
I mean, don't we have the Obama administration trying to do that? We have the Bush administration even talking about these sorts of efficiencies, and yet it seems to be very tepid, lackluster, fits and starts?
Yeah, there's not a sense of urgency that you would get from looking at the CO2 climate trajectory.
I mean, if you looked at that, you would have that sense of urgency.
If you really believe that. But then again, you back up, you can do a lot with efficiency. And that's loading costs onto your own population. So you got to pay $10. My wife gets annoyed. She's got to go down and pay $10 to buy a light bulb. So we have a long way to go on that. So we're doing some things, but I would argue there's not a sense of urgency that I would like to see because energy efficiency is cheaper as a way of doing it. But it's complicated. It takes regulation, enforcement. It takes making those rules. It's very tough stuff. But let me just, without wearing it out, Japan is the superpower of energy efficiency. The U.S. uses twice as much energy per unit of GDP output as Japan. Nobody even comes close to the Japanese in terms of energy efficiency. The Chinese use five times as much energy per unit of GDP than the Japanese. So it can be done, and the Japanese have led the way, but it's interventionist. It's telling people they can't do, you know, making them buy this, making they can't have that. They got to pay a lot more for this. This is tough stuff.
Mike Herberg is research director for the National Bureau of Asian Research's Energy Security Program. He's also a senior lecturer at the University of California, San Diego, and he spent 20 years in the oil industry. China, even though it's pursuing renewables, it's also building many, many coal-fired plants and even looking at other ways of getting energy. Are they also pursuing in their policies any energy efficiency in new construction, for example?
Oh, yeah. I mean, by law now in China, you can't build a power plant that's not what's called supercritical, which burns more efficiently, hotter, and you get more energy per pound of coal you put in, or ultra-supercritical. You go up the steps, silly names. But by law, you cannot build one that's not in this very high category of efficiency. Do some get built? Yes, below that, because China's enforcement is a serious problem. They are enforcing mileage standards for vehicles. They put taxes on large engines. They're moving on efficiency in the electricity sector, building efficiency. I mean, they really are doing a lot. The challenge is that the scale of the behemoth is so large that it's a tough one to really make much of a dent in this trajectory. But they are working hard. They have announced they're in the middle of implementing six pilot emissions trading systems in six different provinces or cities. In a lot of ways, they're doing a lot more than we are.
Yeah. Mike Herberg has been studying energy and country risk analysis and portfolio risk management for ARCO. The climate has already changed. The systems, the processes have already been put in motion.
From my own perspective, you have to see this as an insurance policy. We don't know what's going to happen, but there's a significant risk that this is going to be disastrous. And like anything, you don't expect to get a car accident, but you buy car insurance in case it does. We need to insure against the possibility that this is where we're headed. It's a simple concept. It's not about will it happen or won't. It's about the risks are significant, non-trivial, and we need to put in place an insurance policy. And it's very hard because you got to decide who's going to pay the premium and how you divide the premium of which countries pay what share of the premium. It's a real simple way to think about it. And nobody wants to agree on that, so we don't buy the insurance.
Michael Herberg spent 20 years in the oil industry's research director in the Energy Security Program at the Seattle-based National Bureau of Research. Last week, Governor Jay Inslee proposed the state update its carbon reduction and clean energy plan. He wants a review of the state's emissions, and he wants to get his Carbon Emissions Reduction Task Force to recommend the design and implement a market-based carbon emissions reduction program. This is The Record.